lecture for Biochem 422, and this is January 29, I believe. Correct? 2010. Still a little bit, got some residual effects from, I think it was just a bad cold, and just miserable. It must have some sinus thing to it, too, as well. I don't know how I managed to miss the flu that went through, but pick up this cold. Anyway, I still have, I'm still here thanks to drugs. Yes! Biochemistry in action. And so we're going to get started on this. Now, we're now still at the very tail end of chapter 22. We're talking about pentose phosphate pathway. And we're looking at the last two slides, the one of which says oxidative steps. I'd just like to have you write as a sidebar to this, glucose 6-phosphate dehydrogenase. Glucose 6-phosphate dehydrogenase. I think that's how they do it. G6PD. G6PD is an enzyme, obviously, that's a part of, that's that first committed step in the pentose phosphate pathway. But a genetic deficiency leads to a blood disorder. Actually, I think the blood disorder is some sort of anemia. In other words, that you've got trouble with getting enough iron, enough... It's just a problem. So genetic deficiency leads to a blood disorder, and you might wonder, how in the world does that work? How in the world does that work? Well, so how can I say this? I don't even know where to begin on this. Etiology. The etiology, ology. So in other words, this etiology, means the basis for this disease, or the root cause, as it were. There is a compound that's circulating in your red blood cells called glutathione. Glutathione. It's a protein with important cysteine residue, a cysteine amino. So it's a glutathione. It's a protein that's got its important cysteine residues, or amino acids. What happens is this. Glutathione is many times abbreviated as GSH. GSH, glutathione. Now the G stands for the glute. This is the glutathione, but the SH represents the cysteine residue that's sticking out. Glutathione is an important antioxidant. It's an important antioxidant. What happens here is that it reacts with peroxides that are made due to the presence of oxygen with certain other enzymes. So this is a peroxide. And what happens is it gets oxidized, GSSG. You make a disulfide, a diglutathione, and then you make two ROHs. You make two alcohols out of it. And so that reduces it intentionally. There's an enzyme, I don't know the name of it. It's not glutathione reductase. That's a different enzyme. That's the other thing. This is there's an enzyme whose name I've forgotten, and there may be just more than one. Not exime, although that would be an interesting. I just came up with a new word, exime, enzyme that that helps break down this peroxide. But the key here is that these peroxides that exist can attack the lipids. So the peroxide that's formed due to the excess oxygen that's in the red blood cell, these peroxides that can be formed attack the lipids in the membranes and weaken them. And so that's one mechanism where you have anemia, where the red blood cell wall is weakened, the membranes weakened because of the presence of these peroxides, if they're not immediately reduced by the glutathione. So this seems like a process that's completely independent of whatever pentose phosphate pathway, except for this next step, and that is this glutathione regeneration. Well, this GSSG here, this disulfide bond, this where it links the two glutathiones together, if this is going to be restored into a state that it can continue to act on these glutathiones, it's got to be reduced. So what happens is you get the GSSG plus NADPH, and now you're suddenly realizing where all this is coming in from, and I'm not sure biochemists never really balance chemical equations, okay? I mean, we don't worry about it that much. So you get two glutathiones, and then you get the two NADP pluses. And of course, so obviously, this thing, the NADPHs, is dependent on active pentose phosphate pathway. So here is it's an interesting thing. So and the pentose phosphate pathway does exist in the red blood cell. And the red blood cell does not contain any mitochondria. No. No mitochondria does have all the enzymes necessary for glycolysis. So the red blood cell does not contain mitochondria. It does contain all the enzymes for glycolysis, and it has the pentose phosphate pathway. And one of the main reasons why it has the pentose phosphate pathway is just to regenerate the NADPH that then helps reduce the glutathione dimer down to glutathione to help whack the peroxides that are made in the red blood cell due to their constant exposure to high concentrations of oxygen. And so a genetic deficiency in this G6DP then ends up having a problem with your red blood cell integrity, and you get anemia out of it. It really is one of these wonderful things, the interrelationship in our bodies with how does a disease here cause these symptoms. It's really a kind of interesting thing. All right. So you can see the oxidative steps. I don't really care about that. Now, this is an interesting one. This is not directly related to the pentose phosphate pathway, but I threw this in here because it really is a fascinating display of, you know, what happens in exercise and where you get your energy equivalents from in exercise. We can see here contribution of various energy sources to muscle activity during mild exercise, consumption of glycogen stores in fast-switch muscles during light, moderate, and heavy exercise, rate of glycogen replenishment following exhaustive exercises, 1992 or 1998, interesting. So, duration of work in 60 seconds. 60 seconds, look at this. So, where are you getting your energy from? So, here is the first second or two of moderate work that you're doing. It comes from the ATP reservoirs. That's this first line right here that exists in the muscle tissue. The next, see this next purple line that goes up and then down, the next 20 or 30 seconds comes from phosphocreatine. Now, we've not talked much about phosphocreatine. It is the ATP buffer in the cell. Phosphocreatine. I wish I had a diagram for it, but I don't. It's a simple molecule, and but nevertheless, it is an ATP buffer. In other words, that it's a high-energy molecule that can be immediately immediately transfer its high-energy bonds to ADP. Maybe I should do it like this. So you have phosphocreatine. You're going to put a P with a circle indicating its high energy, plus ADP yields, creatine plus ATP. So in other words, that this creatine phosphate is a high energy reservoir. High energy phosphate reservoir. And I think that's how you, is that how you spell reservoir?
I think it's V-O-I-R.
V-O-I-R? Okay, could be. Reservoir, if you're French. Yes?
So can you say that creatine basically phosphorylates the ADP?
Yes. This high-energy phosphate is immediately transferred to the ADP and phosphorylates to make it ATP. That's right. So as you can see here in the muscles, there's enough of that phosphocreatine that's in there that you can extend that the duration of work. I mean, it provides the energy necessary between maybe 5 or 6 seconds to about 20 seconds. So then what happens? So you begin to exhaust that ATP from the phosphocreatine, the energy reservoir, and you can see here in this line, right here, this anaerobic metabolism, that's a code word for glycolysis. The anaerobic metabolism is code word for glycolysis. Aerobic metabolism is probably code word for what? Aerobic. That would be the citric acid cycle, Krebs cycle, and the electron transport system. Aerobic metabolism. So, within about 90 seconds or so, or even less, between 60 and 90 seconds of moderate exercise, you're moving from what energy reserves you have in your body to aerobic metabolism. And that, of course, requires the limit that you find on aerobic metabolism primarily deals with oxygen carrying capacity of your lungs and circulatory system. When you look at Lance Armstrong, the bicyclist, and when you look at some of the doping that they do, most of the doping has to do with circulatory issues. They're trying to keep their circulation system open. He is probably some sort of genetic anomaly in which he has hit a sweet spot in terms of aerobic capacity, heart pumping efficiency, capillary bed size and scope. There are probably others in the world that have that same capacity, but they're not bicyclists and will never know that they have that capacity. So so you can see immediately the aerobic metabolism. This is actually then, aerobic metabolism begins the initial use of fat. So especially in muscle tissues, the fatty metabolism is immediately called upon within the first 90 seconds to a minute. So that's why if you can, exercise is very helpful for reducing your amount of your fat. The key for losing weight is to use more calories than you eat. That's fundamentally it. There's no other way around it. And I don't care what your genetics are. The body can't manufacture energy out of nothing. Okay, you cannot manufacture energy out of nothing. If you're eating less than you're consuming, if you're eating less in calories and you're consuming in calories and doing exercise and stuff, you will lose weight. You can't help it. So that's the most interesting one of the two. And then let's see, what's this one? Consumption of glycogen stores and fast twitch. So light exercise doesn't use very much glycogen. Moderate uses quite a bit. And heavy exercise uses up that glycogen. So 60 minutes of heavy exercise, assuming I'm sure this is during light, moderate consumption of glycogen stores. And this is assuming that you have your full complement of glycogen stores in the muscles. If you have managed to not eat over 12 hours or whatever, the percentage that you're using here is going to be much lower. In other words, it says percent of glycogen stores or glycogen content. Maybe you may start out at 100%, but if you haven't eaten in a while, that's going to be, the 100% is going to be much less than if you began to exercise in the afternoon after two big meals. Nevertheless, at the end of 60 minutes of heavy exercise, you're not going to have much glycogen left, no matter what you start with. And lastly here, how do you get carbohydrates back? And notice here, heavy exercise if you're running a marathon. So assuming you are completely carbo-loaded because you've eaten nothing but spaghetti for the last 3 days, at the end of the first hour, you're all done with your carbohydrate stores. And so what are you using for your major, what at a very minimum are you using for your major muscle groups to move? It's got to be fat. You're using fat. So marathoners, you're never going to see an overweight marathoner. Never. I mean, someone who's truly marathoning is, they are not going to have any excess. They almost can't get enough. They almost can't eat enough is the situation. So the 2 hours of exercise and a high carbohydrate diet gets the glycogen back, no food, and a fat and protein diet. Look at that. Actually, a fat and protein diet actually hinders the rate of glycogen development in the body. So this is the that fat and protein diet is the Scarsdale diet or what was that other diet where you could eat? Atkins diet, yeah. But you see, one of the reasons why this works is, oddly enough, one of the reasons why it works, and I'm glad it's fallen out of favor, but glycogen is highly water-soluble. I mean, it's hygroscopic. There's a lot of hydroxies, right? And so what happens is the glycogen, as it builds up in your liver and so on, and a muscle tissue begins to have a water of solvation around it, which adds a significant amount of weight to your body. So that in an Atkins diet, where you're not encouraging the production of glycogen, you're going to shed all that glycogen and you're going to shed all the water associated with the glycogen, and so you're going to have immediate weight loss of significant amount. If you're really overweight and you have a lot of glycogen in your body, and you start forcing your body away from making the glycogen, you're going to lose the glycogen, and you're going to lose the water associated with it. So you use a lot of weight from that initially. and it appears like it doesn't come back either. Notice, even out 5 or 10 days fat and protein diet, you're just not getting that glycogen back. Now, as you know, the central role of carbohydrate metabolism in each of the cells you have, you're distorting your metabolism. Apparently, the body can adapt to it, but it can't be happy about it. I'm sure there's long-term problems. But anyway, all right, we're going to go on now. Do you have this handout with you? I believe you do. Is that correct? All right. Now, let's do some classroom management right in this transition before we get too far, because I only have 10 minutes. Now, according to the schedule, we have a test on Monday. Is that right? Now, I would like to meet with you on Sunday, if you would like, so that we can do a quick review of the subject matter. I hate to do this to you, but it appears like my Sunday afternoons pretty much booked up. And I'm wondering if we could meet Sunday morning. I hate to do that.
I don't think that would be a possibility for me.
Okay. That's right. Okay, so you'll be in church, is that right?
Yeah. I know I'm not like you guys. But...
Sure. No. All right, well then that's an issue. I want to adapt to meet you. When could you come, or would you... What would be best for you? Right.
I wasn't planning on coming any extra days.
Okay, all right. I want to be as accommodating as I can be. Could we shift the test to Wednesday? No?
We have histology on the wall. Nobody's on there. But I also have histology.
You have histology?
Yeah. Oh,
so Wednesday's not good, huh? Can you meet with me this afternoon?
Yeah, well, what time? I could, but maybe right after chapel?
Yes, I think so. Right after chapel, you mean at 12:30?
Yeah.
Yeah, come and see me. Let's you and I just go through. Okay, then you don't have to come at all. And, I'm going to eat lunch while we talk, if that's okay.
Yeah, that's perfect.
All right. So the rest of you, is that okay if we do it on Sunday morning? I'm thinking like 10. Does that be too soon? All right. So 10 a.m. for an hour. What?
11?
No, I'm pretty sure I would say 11, except, and I apologize for not telling you, I think I'm going to have a test review for my intro to Kim at 11. We had one last time. We had a test. It was at 11, and so it seemed to be a better time to have it. Was at 11 for them, at least for the majority of them. So I know 10 may be a little early for you in the morning, but is that okay? 10 a.m. All right. So let's do 10 a.m. Sunday and. I don't have a key to get in here, so we're either going to do it in the amphitheater, or if that's not possible, we'll do it in 317. Okay. Check your email to make sure that I'm going to be here. If you don't hear from me, I'm going to be here. Okay. If you hear from me, something's happened and I can't make it. So before you schlep out of bed at 5 till 10. come and check your email. I'll send a note. But if you don't hear from me, we're going to be here. And so the test is going to be on Monday. Oh, my goodness. Okay. And that means I have to figure out when I can write this thing. Hallelujah. I'll try to see if I can come up with an old test as well. Check your email, and I'll try to get an old test going for you. No. We are going to have 4 minutes of chapter 23 and 24, so I don't think so. Although it would be a lot of fun to do it, wouldn't it? All right, so where am I here? Oh, yeah. How many of you like fat? Raise your hand if you're like fat. Absolutely. And the rest of you either aren't paying attention or are lying, because we all like fat. It all tastes good, it fills us up, and it is genetically a desirable thing. Your body always presumes that you don't know where your next meal is coming from, so it tries to store fat for you. And as you can tell, fat was not always out as far as a beautiful woman. Rubin, the painter in the 1700s or 1600s, 1700s, had these Rubenesque nudes. And they're just roly-poly, and they are just, you know, draped across a purple cloth. And Paris Hilton would be considered to be ugly, 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 ugly 200 years ago. Because everybody looked like Paris Hilton 200 years ago. Everybody had to work outside. Why in the world? Why in the world did you walk around with a parasol when in the King Louis or whatever the 16th in France? All the women were all, and they'd powder their faces white. Why would they do that? Because you, right? Oh, the only tan people were the laborers. And the peasants were tanned. So the pastier you were and the fatter you were, yum. So, my, how things have changed, isn't it, right? And in probably less than two generations, you go from agricultural society to now where less than 3% of the United States works in agriculture and produces enough food to feed us and a good part of the world. At any rate, so I'm going to go to Florida over spring break, and I hope to come back with a little bit of a tan, which, of course, is a ridiculous thing. But anyway, because I'm basically translucent, if I got any more pasty white, you could begin to see my organs. You know, it's like drawing paper. I have no melatonin or melanin. Is it melanin? Okay. Anyway. So, hopefully what I'm going to do on Wednesday when we do this again is I'm going to bring, you don't mind if I bring some Oreo cookies, do you? Oreo cookies. And we're going to twist it off and we're going to scrape it off, scrape that interior off. And we're going to note the sensation of it as we begin this. Because we're going to talk about the digestion absorption of dietary lipids. Dietary lipids. And so it is, and it literally begins, there is a lipase that they've finally detected, acid-stable lipase that's secreted at the back of your throat. That's where they first found it. That actually follows your fat down into your stomach and begins to act on the fat right there. But that's not where you get most of your digestion of fat. So, begins this acid-labeled lipase secreted in the back of the tongue. Completion of digestion, absorption of lipids takes place primarily in the lumen of the small intestine. Lumen of the small intestine. So in the lumen of the small intestine, you have to have bile salts, bile acids or bile salts. You have to have an enzyme called lipase. You have to have a protein called cholipase. And you have other lipases that deal with the variations of the lipids that you've got. The phospholipase A2, other phospholipases, these are acting on the lipids of the membranes. If you remember, phospholipids are what membranes are composed of. Anytime you're eating anything that was alive, it's going to have a lot of phospholipids in it because it had to be cellular based. And the cellular basis means it's got lipids with it, phospholipids. The lipase acts primarily on the fat or oils. That is, when I mean fat or oils, I mean literally the triglyceride backbone fats or oils. The cholipase stabilizes the lipase. Let me show you what that means. Why would you have to have that? Well, a lipase the lipase has got a problem, and that is, it's like, oh, the rather crude way of putting it is it's, how do two porcupines mate? How do two porcupines mate? And not even knowing how they actually do it, I would have to say very carefully. And this is the same way that's what's going on here. And I apologize, that's not too embarrassing, but you have this oil droplet. And this is very, very, this is very tiny. It's now a bit emulsified to one degree or another. So it's this oil droplet's not even visible. It's all a microscopic amount of oil droplet. Lots of water around it. But as you know, the lipase will come in here and sits at this interface between the oil and the water. But we know most water-soluble proteins have a hydrophobic interior. Have a hydrophobic interior, and yet it's interacting with oil. What would normally happen, and what does happen, is that this lipase becomes unstable in its contact with the oil droplet, because the oil droplet begins to dissolve the interior of the protein of this lipase and begins to unfold. So another enzyme, another protein comes in called that colipase. The colipase comes in and helps stabilize the structure of the lipase at the oil-water interface, so the lipase can act on the oil droplet and, of course, produce the fatty acids and glycerol that are required, that are the breakdown products of oil. You get fatty acids out of it and glycerol. So that's the role of the colipase, and of course it's 1-to-1, which means you have one for every lipase. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. We'll see you guys on Sunday at 10 a.m. Please bring all your materials. I'll try to let you know what I think is important and so on. And Ken and I will meet today at 12:30, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.